off on the killings. Not on the first five, anyway. The Gleasons and the Schmidts, and Judd, Sr. Judd Jr. might have been a cleaning up. But after he killed the Gleasons, I think he decided to try to pin it on Fur, just in case. And maybe because his office was right there with the Judds, he knew that Judd Jr. and Fur were involved with each other, and he could throw enough suspicion on Fur to create doubt, even if we did tumble to him. So he started by planning the revelation, then the Salem. And to tell you the truth, those documents we found in Judd's computer, there wasn't a thing in Judd's own machine, but they were right there in his secretary's. Like they were planted? Jensen asked. I don't know, Virgil said, but when Jim saw them, he drew a line from anhydrous ammonia to ethanol to meth pretty goddamn quick. It jumped up and bit you on the ass. Williamson's office has an internal connection with the Judds, Big Curly said. There are equipment and storage spaces behind all three offices with connecting doors. He could have sat in there as long as he wanted, at night, working on the locks. Maybe they weren't even locked. It was all behind the same security system. He used to work all night sometimes. Nobody would have thought anything of it, seeing him come out of there in the middle of the night. The thing about framing Fur is, it might still work, Jensen said. It might, Virgil agreed. A decent defense attorney will put Judd and Fur on trial, tie them to the Gleasons and the Schmidts. The Gleasons and the Schmidts did help cover up a murder. Jensen, what? I'm keeping some of it confidential, Virgil said, but I'll fill you in later. The three deputies looked at each other. What are you going to do? Big Curly asked. Nothing right now. Just keep your eyes open and your heads down. Little Curly stood up and said, That's it? Virgil nodded. Yeah, I'm willing to hold this talk privately. I'm not required to file a public report. But I really do think you should drop any election plans. It might even be a good idea to show some public support for Jim Stryker for re-election. Big Curly said, Shit. 6 people dead so far, Virgil said. Your relationship with Williamson would be a tough thing to come up during an election year. Big Curly looked around the courtroom and said, There are things that ain't right about this place. Little Curly interrupted, Shut up, Dad. He said to Virgil, It's a deal. We're back in Jim. To his father, Let's go, Dad. Come on. Let's go. They trooped out, but a couple of seconds later, Big Curly stuck his head back inside the courtroom. I'm sorry, he said. Then he was gone. Jensen said, Now what? I'm not sure that any of this will get a conviction. I gotta run an errand, Virgil said. I'll be back in the early afternoon. Jesse Lehman was sitting at the bar eating a cheeseburger, talking to a guy with a flat top and a red face, whose arm was very close to hers. They both had beer glasses in front of them. Her ass looked terrific on a bar stool, Virgil thought, as he pulled up next to her and said, Hello, darling. Am I late? The flat-top guy gave him a drop-dead stare, and Jesse said, Hey, Virgil. She pointed to the beefy guy and said, This is Chuck, Marker, the beefy guy said. Marker, who's a deputy sheriff from Candiota County, she said. We have some friends in common in Wilmar, and Chuck, this is Virgil Flowers, of the Bureau of Criminal Apprehension, who's trying to keep me from being murdered. Marker straightened a little. What? She's the center of a pretty big... Say, you guys known each other long? Virgil asked, looking from one to the other. Marker picked up his glass. About 10 minutes. I'd better get back to my meeting. When he was gone, Jesse smiled and patted Virgil on the arm and said, That wasn't very nice. Well, I don't have a lot of time. I'm here to bullshit you into doing something that you won't want to do, Virgil said. Do I get to wear a wire? Well, they're not actually wires anymore, but they're sort of like that, Virgil said. Smaller. But I do want you to have a chat with Todd Williamson. He's called me on my cell a couple of times, but I haven't answered, she said. Eat your lunch. I'll get a cheeseburger. Then we'll give him a call back. I've got a script for you. You think he's the one? Maybe, Virgil said. Evidence seems to be piling up. You think he'll admit it to me? Hard to tell, Virgil said. Could be putty in the hands of a pretty woman. Yeah, right. She held up a finger to the bartender. Bill, please. Give it to this guy. Chapter 23. Virgil got on the extension, listened through four rings, and then Williamson picked up. Jesse said, Todd, I'm sorry I'm late, but I conked out last night. You called me? Just to tell you that I talked to Judge Solms last night, and he said that we both ought to get started on DNA testing. We can get kits from the same lab that the sheriff's office uses, and have them witnessed by a court clerk or a sheriff's deputy, and send them off for testing. That'll clear up our rights to the estate of the Judds. I'm still kinda uncertain. I know that you've pretty much got it nailed down. Ah, you're a Judd, Jesse said. You can see it in you, if you look. You can see it in me, too. So what do? Suck some blood or something? No, it's just a little kit with a Q-tip on the end of it. And then we scrub the inside of our cheeks. No blood, nothing like that. Doesn't hurt. It's like brushing your teeth. Solms said the reason for using the same lab is we can get a better price on comparing the DNA to the two Judds. All right, Jesse said. She was interested. What do? Just call the sheriff's department and make a date? Call Solms' clerk, Williamson said. She'll set it up for you. They might have Margot Carr come over from the sheriff's office to supervise. Make sure we do it right. Okay? Virgil thought he was about to ring off and made a rolling motion with his forefinger, and Jesse nodded and jumped in. I'd like to talk to you about Virgil Flowers. I'm really getting confused about this. You know, Mom and I visit Betsy Carlson over in Sioux Falls at the rest home every once in a while. Do you know Betsy? I know who she is, Williamson said. Never met her. Well, the last time we went over there, her mind wanders. We told her some of the things that were going on. We told her that Bill Judd died. We thought maybe she was in a will or something. Anyway, when we told her, she got all excited and said she'd seen the man in the moon. She was really freaked out about it. She'd seen the man in the moon. I'm sorry, Williamson said. What are you talking about? Well, I noticed one time you've got that man in the moon tattoo on your arm. I thought maybe she was talking about that. And Virgil's been asking me about the man in the moon because I've got man in the moon earrings. And, well, what's this man in the moon stuff? Williamson said, I don't know. Betsy wasn't talking about me. How could she be? We never met. I thought, I don't know, Jesse said. You look a little like Bill Judd, and if you'd interviewed her or something. Nope, never did, Williamson said. She was in the home long before I got here. All right, Jesse said. Still, I'd like to talk about Virgil. I'm over in Worthington with my mom. I won't be back until late, till the stores close. You think we could hook up somewhere in Bluestem, like at the Dairy Queen? I'll probably be back at 9:30 or 10. Let me think. What time do they close the Dairy Queen? 11? Tell you what, let's hook up at 10. I'm working late tonight. I could walk over. See you then, she said. She rang off and Virgil flopped back on the bed. Excellent, he said. You really think he did it? Margaret Lehman asked. She was sitting on the other bed, had been looking on in bemusement as Virgil and Jesse worked on the phone call. Yes, probably. But not for sure, Virgil said. If he shows up tonight, he could dig his own grave. Or he might clear himself. Either way, I get rid of a major suspect. Margaret looked at her daughter. Told you, pure cop. Chapter 24. When the out-of-town cops had been milling around the salad bar, Virgil had spotted a deputy from Dodge County that he'd done some work with a few months earlier. When they got off the phone with Williamson, he took Jesse along and introduced her to the guy, whose name was Steve Jacobs. Jacobs was chatting with another cop, a deputy named Roger Clark from Goodhue County. Virgil told them about the killings in Bluestem and introduced Jesse as one of the people under threat. It'd be good if we could get her bodyguarded until this evening, Virgil suggested. I'll guard her body as long as she wants, Jacob said. Me too, Clark said. Jesse said, ha ha, but she liked the attention. Virgil, I'm a little serious here, Jesse. I don't want you running around outside. Todd's a smart guy, and until we figure out how to drag him down, you've got to be careful. Mom and I were planning to go shopping and then come back here and watch some movies, she said. Don't get alone, Virgil said. You should be okay, but just don't get alone. I'll be back by 8 o'clock to get you wired up. If you get the smallest little crinkle of thought that something's wrong, find Steve here, or Roger, or one of these other cops, and tell him. I'll be okay, she said. Jacob said, we'll keep an eye on her. Where are you going? Jesse asked Virgil. I've got an appointment at the fire department to learn CPR, and then I'll poke around, see if I can spot Todd without being too obvious about it. CPR? It's a life-saving technique, Virgil said. She frowned, then shook her head. Whatever. Don't get alone. Virgil left her with Jacobs and Clark, headed back to Bluestem, stopped at the fire department. A big man with a handlebar mustache met him, took him back to an equipment locker, opened a door. There you go, he said. On the way back to Bluestem, Virgil called Joan. Where are you? At the post office, she said. Then where are you going? Might go home and watch television, she said. What are you doing? Trying to contain my animal spirits. The great thing about daytime sex, Virgil thought privately, is that you gotta watch. Women didn't like to watch so much, which was understandable, because they were watching men, and men having sex wasn't that interesting. At least not to Virgil. Women having sex was, which was why he liked daytime sex. And Joan said, I gotta give this up and get something regular. You had something regular, Virgil said. You're right, she said. Once a year is regular, just not frequent. I need something regular and frequent. Not all over the goddamn place, morning, noon, and night. That would be nooner. You know, people haven't used that term in 50 years, she said. You are such a small-town guy. I've heard it 4 times since I've been here, he said. Tends to stick in your mind. I'm not positive that you've got enough extra space to collect small-town sayings, Joan said. Virgil said, bite me. She rolled over on her stomach. So what's the big mystery? I've got it worked out that Todd Williamson is going to hang himself tonight. Or clear himself. I'll take either one. Her eyebrows went up. How are you going to do that? That's complicated and confidential. However, I will take either one. If I clear him, never mind. On the way out to the truck, Virgil noticed a clump of multicolored paper sheets stacked on the kitchen table. Crop insurance, Joan said. Everything the federal government touches turns into quadruplicate or quintuplicate or something, and it takes days to fill it all out, and then they do it all over next time. Virgil looked over the forms. Christ, I don't even understand the words. I'm the party of the foreplay, she said. The government's the party of the gangbang. See, it's right here. Virgil left Jones and cruised the back of the newspaper building, in a mood now. A mood going sour. He saw Williamson's truck, so he was probably in. He parked in the Ace Hardware lot for 20 minutes, watched the front of the newspaper, 2 blocks away, saw nothing. Moved to the McDonald's lot, parked behind the restaurant, and watched the newspaper by looking straight through the building's windows, feeling somewhat invisible. 45 minutes after he began watching, Williamson came out of the newspaper, walking fast, crossed the street in the middle of the block, and went into Johnny's Pizza. 5 minutes later, he came out with a pizza box and a soft drink cup, crossed the street back to his office. So Williamson was working. Virgil called Stryker. I need to get you and 5 deputies to work tonight. I'd like to get the Curleys, Jensen, Carr, a couple more guys. Hook up tonight at 8 o'clock, to whenever. What are we doing? Surveillance and maybe an arrest. I'll brief everybody at 8 at the courthouse. Tell everybody to be on time and to keep their mouths shut. I don't want any of the other deputies to know about it. You think something could happen or maybe not. Can't take a chance. When he got off the phone, Virgil spent another 10 minutes watching the news. 5 o'clock. The rest of the day would drag. He'd deliberately set the meeting between Williamson and Jesse Lehman for after dark, because he thought the killer would feel safer. Fewer people around. And if he trailed Jesse afterwards, he'd be easier to tag. Still, a long time to wait. Maybe go back to Jones? Maybe not. He thought about it, fired up the truck, and headed back to Worthington. Margaret and Jesse were in their room, watching a movie about languid Englishmen and women who lived in London at the beginning of the 20th century. "We're kinda into this movie. Could we do the planning thing afterwards? There's only 20 minutes left." "We got time," Virgil said. He left his sound kit next to the bed and went out to the lounge. Had a beer, watched the end of a Twins-White Sox game, and walked back to the room at 7 o'clock. To Jesse, "There is some small risk for you, but not as much as letting him go on. I don't believe there's any chance that he'll attack you at the Dairy Queen. Just in case, we're going to have a deputy sitting outside eating an ice cream cone. I'm thinking Margot Carr with a gun." Margaret said, "If Todd is a lunatic, how do we know he won't just explode and start killing people?" "Because if he is a lunatic, he's a special kind," Virgil said. "He's a planner. He's meticulous. He'll do it, but he'll lower his odds of getting caught, however he can. He won't just start blasting away." Jesse asked, "Then what do you think he'll do?" "He'll meet you. He'll bullshit you. He'll find out what you're planning to do. Then he'll come after you. Might have a long gun. Pull up beside you on the road home. After you get off the highway, take a shot. Might dump his car and walk to your house, and then come in after both of you. That's what we're hoping he'll do."
"You're hoping he'll do that?"
Margaret asked. "Jim Stryker and I and the Curleys and Larry Jensen will be staking him out. Margot will be at the Dairy Queen. Two more will actually be inside your house. We'll drop them off early. I'll need a key from you." So Jesse goes and talks to Todd, then she gets in her truck and she takes off. And when she gets out on the highway, she really rolls. He looked at Jesse. "You move just as fast as you're comfortable with."
"I'm pretty comfortable with 90, she said.
"That's good. You've only got a few miles down to your exit. If you get even a small jump on him, he won't be able to catch you before you get home. We'll have two guys on the highway in front of you. When you get home, you go in the back door and right down the basement. The two guys who are in front of you will keep going, two blocks down the way, and then out on their feet. Then we've got two guys inside if he goes in after Jesse, and two outside, and two more right behind him."
"What am I doing during all this?" Margaret asked.
"I'd like you to stay here," Virgil asked, "or wait in my room down in Bluestem. We'll keep you right up to date on what's going on." Virgil picked up his sound kit and unzipped it. The two microphones and transmitter together were no bigger than a matchbox, and the microphones themselves were as thin as pennies. "This is a radio," Virgil said, showing it to them. "There are two microphones. They route separately through the transmitter, like a cell phone, but the microphones are way better. We'll tape the mics to your chest, best if you wear a t-shirt, and clip the transmitter inside the waist of your jeans at the small of your back. We'll both be able to hear you and record it at the same time. When you meet him, you push him about the moon tattoo, the man in the moon thing," Virgil continued. "You push him about how he must have known that Judd was his father. How could a Twin Cities newspaper reporter, with all that curiosity and all those records right there in St. Paul, not know who his father was? And didn't he have grandparents? And wouldn't they know? He won't want you to ask those questions. He'll be pretty hot about keeping you from asking. I think he'll be right after you."
"What if he doesn't do all that?" Jesse asked. "What if he goes home and goes to bed?"
Virgil said, "Well, shoot. Then we'd have to start over with something else. But he was calling you because he wants to make some kind of move, I think."
"I'd like to get it over with," Jesse said.
"We all would," Virgil said.
"So, you want to take your shirt off?"
When he left Worthington the second time, at 7:30, Jesse was ready to roll. The wire tested both for recording fidelity and for direct sound. At 8:05, Virgil was back at the courthouse. Daylight was beginning to fade, the shadows long across Main Street, red light reflecting off west-facing windows. Sundown would come a few minutes before 9 o'clock.
Stryker was waiting, with the two Curleys, Jensen, Carr, and two guys named Paget and Brooks. Virgil leaned on the front edge of Stryker's desk. "I've pulled together evidence that suggests that Todd Williamson might have been capable of doing the Gleason and Schmidt killings and the two Judds and might have been inclined to do them. I'm going to feed that evidence back to him tonight through Jesse Lehman and hope that it forces him into an overt act. They're going to meet at 10 o'clock at the Dairy Queen. After the meeting, which I'm set up to record and to monitor, Jesse is going to take off as fast as she can for home. So fast that Williamson won't be able to ambush her or run her off the road on the way. Deputies Paget and Brooks," he nodded at them, "will already be at her house waiting. Jim and Larry will try to figure out where Williamson is before he goes to the meeting, stake him out, and track him toward the Dairy Queen. The two Curleys will be down south of the Dairy Queen in separate cars. Once Jesse takes off, I want you two in front of her, heading back to her place. The rest of us will follow behind, so we'll have him boxed in if he goes after her." "What about me?" Carr asked. "I've got something touchy if you're willing to do it," Virgil said. "I want you in civvies, but with a gun. This guy is dangerous. You'll be in your own car, and as soon as Larry sees Williamson walk into the Dairy Queen, I want you to pull in and order an ice cream cone. Sit outside on one of those benches and lick it down. One hand on your gun." She smiled. "Sounds good to me." "Where'll you be?" Stryker asked Virgil. "I'll be in my truck, parked behind Jane's Nails. I want to stay back in the dark, but I've got to be in radio range too so I can monitor the meeting." "I got a couple of questions," said Brooks. "All right," Virgil said. "Let's do the details. But we've got to be in place an hour before Williamson is due to meet Jesse. By 9 o'clock. Williamson is at his office. We don't want to lose him." He stepped to a wall map of Bluestem on the wall behind Stryker's desk, touched street corners. "I figure Stryker and Jensen will be here and here, covering the front and back doors of the newspaper office." When he was done, Carr asked, "So if Todd doesn't do anything, we just go home?" "No, we'll be giving him a serious push. He won't want Jesse Lehman to talk to me. I think he'll have to do something. If Jesse takes off and Williamson goes home or back to his office or wherever, we'll tag him. Overnight, anyway. And just in case he figures out a way to sneak off, I want Paget and Brooks to hang at Jesse's overnight." He nodded at the two men. "If nothing happens, I'll join you out there early tomorrow, and I'll ship Jesse back to her hideout while I try to figure something else." "All seems a little shaky," Brooks said. "It's a lot shaky," Virgil said. "But to tell you the truth, with what I've got now and what I'm likely to get, I don't think we've got a conviction. He'll get away with it, unless he kills somebody else and trips up. We got to take the shot." "Not against that," Brooks said. "I'm just saying." "I hear you," Virgil said. "I'm more worried than you are." "What if he really didn't do it?" Jensen asked. Virgil smiled. He'd been waiting for that question. "That's almost as good. If we clear him, I think I can work out who we're really looking at. We've really got quite a bit of detail once you sift it out," Virgil said. "What detail?" Stryker asked. Virgil shrugged. "I got notes, small stuff. Show it to you later." They went over the details one more time, but it wasn't rocket science, and they were done by 8:45. They were all a little hot, eager to get going. And by 9, Virgil was alone in his truck and called Jesse. "You ready to roll?"
"Yep."
"I'm a little nervous." "Good. You should be. We've already got the place staked out," Virgil said. "Margot Carr will be outside. She'll be close enough to be there instantly if you scream. And she's armed. I'll be 5 seconds away on the corner by Sherwin-Williams. Now, remember about the radio check. You call me on your cell when you're coming up to the exit so we can get Margot moving. And then when you're coming into the Dairy Queen, turn on the radio, and I'll make sure you're coming in clear. Don't get out of the truck until I give you the okay."
"Okay.
I'll leave here right at 9:30. "Stay in touch," Virgil said. "You've got my cell. Call me for anything." At 10 after 9, Virgil was squatting between two plastic recycling bins and the back wall of Jane's nails and extensions, a cell phone butt in one ear, a cop radio butt in the other. Stryker called.
All right, I got Williamson. He's at the office. Saw his head in the window, clear as day.
His house is dark, Jensen said. I'm moving up behind the Judd building, looking down the alley toward the back.
A minute later.
I'm looking down the alley. His van is there.
Another minute. Stryker.
Got him again. He's working.
Stryker saw him twice more, the clock creeping around to 9:30.
Virgil.
All right, everybody. Jesse is on her way. Margot, are you there?
At my house, all set in my car.
I'm 2 minutes away, she said.
Big Curly?
Here.
Little Curly?
Looking at the Dairy Queen.
Stay cool, everybody.
Virgil himself was not that cool. He lay behind the two garbage cans with the shotgun, watching his truck across the street.
9:32. 9:35. Like this. He thought the odds that the killer was Williamson were about 30%, 1 in 3. If he was, then Williamson would meet Jesse in the Dairy Queen, and Jesse would unload a whole bunch of things that Virgil had told her about his record, about being Lane, about how he must have known he was Judd's son, just to get there, about talking again with Betsy to see if she could identify him. If that happened, then Williamson would follow her home and try to kill her, and they'd get him. But the Curlys had shown themselves capable of some serious shit. Big Curly had been there the night that Maggie Lane died. Might have known that she'd been beaten before she died. They'd tampered with a murder scene for sure. They said that Todd Williamson had fed them Jesse Lehman as a suspect, and Big Curly said that Williamson had gone through the Gleason house and may have left the revelation. But all of that was what the Curlys said. An alternative. One of the Gleasons, knowing about the cover-up surrounding Maggie Lane's death, had gotten religion, maybe even from Fur, and fearing for their souls, had started talking about coming clean. So the Gleasons had been silenced by someone else involved in the cover-up. Big Curly. Judd suspected something, so Judd died. Roman Schmidt began to put things together, and the Schmidts went down. 30%, Virgil thought. But the Stryker family was deep in this as well. Had the motive to get rid of the Judds. Judd had killed their father and husband. And when Amy Sweet had told Virgil that she'd mentioned the Judd ethanol plant to her bridge group, the one member of the group whose name Virgil had recognized had been Laura Stryker's. So at least one Stryker had known that Judd was headed back toward ethanol, a scheme that might have looked a lot like the Jerusalem artichoke scam. It was possible, he thought, that the Strykers, one or all of them, would not want Williamson cleared, as Virgil had suggested he might be. And Stryker did have a streak of violence in him, as Jesse had suggested. He'd killed Fur and the man named John without turning a hair. 20%, one or all. There was a possibility, which would never really come clear if it were true, that George Fur was behind it all, as Jim Stryker believed. Good reason to believe that. Stryker wasn't a stupid man. 15%. Margaret Lehman was another possibility, although he really didn't think she would have left that pistol in Jesse's boot. Or in any case, he couldn't see why she would do that. Then there were a few outliers. Jensen and Margot Carr. Somebody had planted that revelation in that Salem cigarette butt and had known that Carr would pick it up. Altogether, another 15%. For a total of 105%. Virgil now had them all separated, and one of them, maybe, was worried. He'd carefully primed them all with the belief that he had more information, had more ideas about who the killer might be. And one of them, he thought, the crazy one, the man in the moon, might well be coming with a gun to erase the Virgil Flowers problem. And if nobody did, well then, maybe it was Fur. Maybe. Virgil looked down at his watch. 9:40. Had to be Williamson, Virgil thought. He was still in his shop, under surveillance.
If it was another one of them, he or she would have already made a move. Maybe it was a bust. Then Mooney came out of the shadows. Chapter 25. Virgil had just called Stryker. He moving yet? Not a thing. Lights are still on. Have you seen? At that moment, a figure emerged from the hedge at the back of the Sherwin-Williams store, dressed all in black, except for jogging shoes with reflective strips on the back, little white flashes in the night. Hard to see him, though it was a he. Couldn't be Williamson, because he was still at the paper. The killer jogged silently into a combat hunch to the back, and then down the side of Virgil's truck. Virgil half-stood as the figure lifted the muzzle of a shotgun as he came up to the truck's front door, then stepped back and fired a single shot like thunder and lightning in the night, a flash of exploding glass, through the window on the truck, neatly blowing the head off the CPR dummy that sat behind the wheel. In the flash, Virgil caught his face. Virgil shouted, "Williamson, lay the gun on the ground." Williamson had never struck Virgil as an athlete, but he spun and pumped and fired, and the last words weren't out of Virgil's mouth when lightning flashed at him, but going wide, and he went flat and squeezed off a shot from his own shotgun. But Williamson had vanished. Virgil had the impression that a shot had gone in close, but he learned early that a shotgun was no sure cure in a gunfight. Fucking Williamson. He could hear Stryker screaming on the radio. He picked it up and shouted, "Williamson's out! Williamson's out! He's got a shotgun!" And he ran behind Sherwin Williams. "Kick in the door on his office. Make sure he's not headed back there. He's got a shotgun and I don't know what else. He's shooting, so everybody take it easy. Everybody stay in your cars. See if we can spot him." "You okay? You okay?" Stryker was still screaming. "I'm okay, except I'm scared. Everybody stay cool now. Let's round him up. Margo, are you there? Jensen?" Stryker, "How'd he get out? How'd he get out?" They checked in, all cruising. Little Curly said, "I'm going down the tracks. I'm going down the tracks." Big Curly, "I'm behind Marvin's, heading toward the elevator." A few seconds later, the tornado siren went off. The dispatcher called, "I'm waking up everybody in town. I've got the weather tree going. In 5 minutes, everybody in town will know that it's Williamson, and they'll all be looking out the windows." Margot Carr, "Do you think he cut back across Poplar? If he's headed down to the river, he'll be hard to spot." Jensen, "Tommy, get back to the weather tree. Tell people to lock their doors and call if somebody tries to get at a car." Dispatcher, "Louis Barth says somebody ran down the alley just a minute ago behind his house." Carr, "I'm right there. I'm taking the alley." Virgil had brushed the glass off the seat of his truck, threw the decapitated dummy in the back, and took off, calling, "Careful, careful, Margo, don't let him ambush you. Where am I going? Where am I going?" Saw flashers, north, turned that way. More flashers coming up behind. Dispatcher called, "I've got everybody coming in. We're coming in right on top of you, Margo." Virgil heard the boom of a shotgun, close, no more than a couple of blocks. Called, "Got gunfire, got gunfire." Saw the lights ahead. Cut left, closed, cut left. Found a squad car across a street, a body on the ground. Stryker standing. Then on the radio, "Margo's down. She's hit. He took her car. He's running east on Cleet. He's turning north on 75. Virgil was out on the street, and Stryker shouted, "She's bad. She's bad." "Get her in your truck. Run it to the hospital." Together, they lifted her into the back seat of the truck. She had shotgun pellet wounds in her face and neck. She was semi-conscious, pumping blood. And Stryker took off, and Virgil shouted into the radio to the dispatcher, "Call the emergency room. They've got a gunshot wound coming in. Gonna need a surgeon. Gonna need some blood." "I think I got him. I think I got him," Jensen called. Big Curly, "I got him too. He's running north on 75. And a third cop, unknown to Virgil, "I'm running south on 75. I'm just going past Amber's. I don't see him yet." Virgil took the truck back down the street and cut onto the main drag. Saw flashing lights ahead, accelerating out of town. More lights were filing in behind him, every cop in the city. Then Jensen called, "He's turned off at the park. He's turned at the park. He's headed up to Judd's. He's running out of road." Virgil, "Dispatch, start breaking people around the perimeter of the hill.
We don't want everybody at the same spot up on top. Tell them to put their lights on the hill, but get out of the trucks in the dark behind them. Watch for him coming down the hill.
Virgil was 200 yards behind Big Curly, who was 200 yards behind Jensen, who was a half mile behind Williamson. Virgil saw Carr's truck, driven by Williamson, climbing the hill toward Judd's, then Jensen's taillights flaring as he slowed to turn through the park gates and up the hill, then Big Curly slowing, and then Virgil was slowing, and then Jensen said, "Holy shit, he's turned down the hill toward the bluff, toward the buffalo jump. Man, he's headed right toward it. Jesus Christ."
Virgil had turned and was looking up the hill when he saw the lights of the lead car, Williamson, bounding over humps in the turf, once, twice, and then he was gone.
"He went over," Jensen screamed. "Jesus Christ, he went over!"
Virgil shouted, "Dispatch, get people down there. Larry, stop where you are. Put your headlights down there. Big Curly, get up by Larry. Put your headlights across the slope. I'm coming in. I'll bet he bailed out before the car went over the edge."
Then he was there, pulling past the second cop, pulling past Jensen, playing his lights across the slope. Saw no movement. Was out of the truck. Stepped back to Jensen and Big Curly and said, "Get back out of the light, guys. Get back in the dark."
"Don't see anybody."
"I don't see anybody," Jensen said. He and Big Curly both had shotguns. Virgil popped the back of his truck, unlocked the toolbox, lifted out the semi-auto .30-06 and two magazines, opened his duffel, took out a long-sleeve camo shirt that he used for turkey hunting. "You guys stay here. Watch the light. He'll have to move if he didn't go over the edge." He slapped a magazine into the rifle, worked the bolt one time. "If you see him yell, I can't use the radio, it'd give me away."
"Where are you going?" Big Curly asked.
"I'm going to crawl around up the hill. If he's not dead at the bottom, he must have headed uphill. He'd be crawling."
Jensen, "Man, maybe we ought to wait."
Virgil shook his head. "Can't. Once he's off the hill, he's got 100 miles of cornfields in every direction. We'll get him sooner or later, but not before he kills a couple of farmers for their cars. What we need, Larry, is every cop you can find, throwing a perimeter around this hill. It'll take him a while to get off."
"Get some dogs in," Big Hurley said.
Virgil snapped his fingers. "Do that. Do that right now. If you can get a couple of dogs, tell the handlers to get them to bark. Get them down below. We want them to think that the dogs are coming."
"They will be," Big Curly said.
"No, no. If he sees people coming and feels like he's trapped, he'll go down shooting," Virgil said. "If you have a dog walk right up on him, the handler gets shot. We don't want that. Want the dogs barking, but we don't want them trailing in the dark. I'm going. Keep watching the headlights. If you see him..."
"Take it easy," Jensen said. "Take it easy.
If he's down there at the bottom of the hill, just start honking your horns," Virgil said. "I'll be back."
In the good old days, in 5th, 6th, 7th, and maybe 8th grades, before the whole issue of women came up, Virgil and his male friends would occasionally play war, always on a soft summer evening when the light was fading to dark. There were apple trees in the neighborhood to provide the ammo. A golf ball-sized green apple, thrown at close range, could give you a bruise like a good left hook. Tree lines, fences, hedges, and overgrown bridal wreath bushes provided the cover. One thing everybody learned quickly was that in the dark, even with a bright moon, a full moon hung overhead as Virgil slipped into the grass heading up the hill, was that you were never sure what was human and what was shadow. You learned not to look directly at someone because he could feel you in the dark. You learned to move slowly, like the moon shadows spreading across the open. If you didn't learn, you'd take a shot behind the ear, just as sure as God made little green apples. The war games were still in Virgil's blood, refined by years of hunting. He slipped into the thigh-high blue stem, running in a crouch, then duck-walking and crawling, quickly at first, getting away from the lights of the trucks, then more slowly, feeling his way past hard corners of exposed rock, the occasional bit of brush,
the prickly wild rose. Williamson had essentially rolled the car down the hill the same way his mother's had gone down, and over the bluff. If he'd bailed before it went over, he'd have three choices. Head sideways and down the hill to the west, head up and across it to the north, or head sideways and uphill to the east. He couldn't go south, because that was sheer bluff. Virgil didn't think he would go down and west, because that would take him right into the face of the arriving cops, and also force him to cross the approach road. He could have gone north, but that would have cut across the lights from Jensen's and Big Curly's headlights as they came up the hill. Most likely, Virgil thought, Williamson went east, parallel to the bluff, or slightly northeast, edging away from the bluff. That way, he'd avoid the road altogether, which ended at the ruins of the Judd place. He'd cross below the Judd place, turn more north, across the shoulder of the hill, and after walking down the far side, would step into the ocean of cornfields that spread out below. The corn was high enough that he'd be able to jog, guided by the rose, without being seen. Someplace along the run, he'd cut into a farmer's place, looking for a ride. If Virgil was right, he should cross paths with Williamson above the Judd place. If he was wrong, if Williamson had gone straight north, and he'd made it across the road, then Williamson would be behind him and above him. That wouldn't be good. He stopped for 10 seconds, listening. Could hear men shouting, a long way away, but no horn honking. Williamson had bailed. Could hear crickets. Could hear the crinkle of grass in the breeze. Could hear the rasping zzzks of nighthawks. Listened as hard as he could. Heard nothing more. Moved on. Williamson ran away from the car, into the dark, clutching the shotgun. No particular destination in mind. He'd fucked up, and this was what happened when you fucked up. He'd known that Flowers would be out there on the street, watching the Dairy Queen. What he'd thought was, how stupid does he think I am? That dumb little bitch Jessie Lehman calling him up, laying all that past history stuff on him, like she thought it up herself. The meeting had to be a setup. Had to be. So he'd come up with a counterstroke. It was possible that Flowers had kept his investigation to himself because Stryker and the others were also suspects. And if the newspaper were under surveillance, and if he showed himself there, and then, if he went over the roof, down the whole block, and came down the fire escape on the back of Heartbreeze, and wired it down, and if he nailed Flowers as he waited in his truck, and then cut behind Sherwin-Williams and made it down the alley and back up the fire escape, hell, it was a big risk, but the jig was almost up anyway. Flowers was pushing him, and if he knew about the Williamsons and the way they died. But if he pulled it off, he was good. Flowers killed while he was under surveillance. The shotgun was Judd Jr.'s, and old enough that they'd probably never trace it to him. He could drop it in the street after he fired it. He'd worked through it. Frightened himself, worked through it again, rehearsed it, had, at the last minute, gone to the roof and spotted two watchers. He knew every car in town, certainly knew Strikers and Jensen's, and convinced himself it would work. Scared, sweating, pulling on the black turtleneck, hot in the night, the gloves, his regular black slacks. He'd run the turtleneck and the gloves through the shredder when he got back, he thought, flush them down the toilet. Jesus, what a risk. Jesus, what a rush. End it. End it. He'd almost done it. He'd been sure he had Flowers, if nothing else. Had seen the head in the window of the truck from the back. Had come up just right. Had hardly heard the boom of the shotgun. Had felt the most intense joy at the impact in the glass. And started to run. And then somebody called his name. And he finished turning and saw movement and fired the gun. And realized he'd been had. How stupid does he think I am? The rest of it all passed in a panic flash. He was on foot. He could hear the cop cars all around. Then the lights came around a corner, and car was coming up the alley. He stepped into a hedge, simply pressed back into it,
and when she came up, boom, flash. He had the car. He could hear them screaming on car's radio as he dumped her into the street. And then he was around the corner. And then more lights, and a flasher bar behind him. He hadn't thought about where to go, but he happened to be going north. He heard more cars calling in, heard them calling out his location, felt the squeeze. He wouldn't go far in the car. A last stand wasn't his style. He turned without thinking down the county road that led to the park road, then up the park road to the Judd turnoff, radio blasting, lights behind him, more lights on the road below, and he turned down the crease in the hill that had taken his mother, and thought to follow her over, get it done with. No guts. Bailed at the last moment, grabbing the shotgun as he went. Found himself rolling across the rocks in the dark, as Margot Carr's vehicle rolled down the hill and over the bluff, like a GMC Buffalo. He crawled, got up, started to run. Fell, hurt himself. Take it slower. Slower. The car disappeared, and he dropped into the knee-high prairie grass and began to crawl, the shotgun clattering over the surface rocks. And he crawled and shuffled and duck-walked and hopped, away from the lights, below the pit of the Judd house, along the bluff, to get away, to get anywhere. And he heard a rock rolling. A footstep. Froze. Lights down the hill, men shouting. But here it was as black as a coal bin, and quiet. Another rock. He wasn't alone. Buffalo? There was a fence. Couldn't be a buffalo. Could be a deer. Could be that fucking flowers. Virgil sat at the corner of the hill below a clump of plum trees, none more than about 6 feet high, and all of them armed with sharp spurs. Not quite thorns, but they hurt like hell if you jabbed yourself. He was sitting on a crumbled pile of rock. He hadn't had the eye to hit major college pitching, but he had the arm to be a major college third baseman. He sat and threw rocks into the dark, listening to them hit, listening for a reaction. Heard what he thought might be a footfall below, 100 feet away. Threw a rock out in front of it. The quiet got quieter. Interesting. Threw another rock into the night and picked up the rifle. Nothing. Threw another rock. Williamson had the movement figured. Somebody moving to his right, kicking an occasional rock. He focused. He had 3 shells left. Had to be flowers, didn't it? He thought about firing, but didn't. Instead, amazed at himself, he called, "Virgil? You there?" Virgil heard him clearly below, to the right of the place he'd been throwing rocks. Eased himself flat, pushed the rifle out in front of him. "Todd? You okay?" Williamson. "I'm pretty fucking scared, man." Virgil. "We know you've got that shotgun. Margot's gonna be okay. She's got glass, but she's not gonna die. Give it up." Williamson. "You won't shoot me?" Virgil. "You must have heard about the time I shot at somebody 14 times and missed. Everybody else in town has. I don't want any goddamn gunfight." Williamson. "Judd killed my mom." Virgil. "I know. I got the same opinion from a medical examiner. Judd beat her with a pool cue. She was already dying when she went over the edge. You really were a miracle baby." Williamson had him spotted. Flowers was no more than 30 or 40 feet away, he thought. He was invisible, but then he must be invisible to Flowers as well. He half stood, pointing the gun in the direction of the voice. "I quit," he said. "What do you want me to do?" Virgil said, "Toss the shotgun." Williamson pointed the shotgun and fired, and pumped, and then he was on his back, the shotgun clattering away, and he was looking up at the moon, almost full, and he heard Flowers shouting, and then a bright light cut his eyes, and Flowers was kneeling next to him. The pain cut in. Everything below his waist was on fire. He said to Flowers, "I guess that wasn't too bright." "No, it wasn't," Virgil said. He patted Williamson on the shoulder.
not knowing what else to do.
"Hang in there. We'll have you on your way in a minute."
He stood up and circled the flash.
"Over here, goddammit. We need to carry him. We need a litter, something to carry him with. Let's go, go."
People were running, and Virgil sat down next to Williamson again.
"That was you that shot at me and Joni down in the dell?" Virgil said.
"Uh-huh," Williamson said. Pain and agreement. But of course it had been. That's why he hadn't known about a better place to park and a better approach to the dell. Williamson wasn't a Blue Stem native. Had never taken his girl up to swim in the dell.
"One more question before everybody gets here."
Williamson was fading, but he answered the question, and then Jensen stumbled up, Stryker was there, and more people were yelling, and they started moving Williamson. Too late. The hornet's nest of 30-caliber slugs had taken out a chunk of his femoral artery, a chunk no bigger than a corn kernel. That was enough. Halfway down the hill, Todd Williamson bled out and died.
Chapter 26.
Virgil and Joan took a picnic basket up to the top of the hill above Stryker's dell, spread a blanket, ate pastrami sandwiches, and found faces in the clouds. Virgil was disturbed. He'd never killed anyone before, though he'd once shot a woman in the foot. Joan knew that, and prattled on about other things, trying to pry his mind away from it. He knew what she was doing, and it wasn't working. And she said, "Definitely in love. When Jim was married the first time, it was like, you know, they were obliged to get married. They dated in high school, and everybody else got taken, so they got married. But they never clicked. There wasn't any heat."
"I hope it works out," Virgil said. "Jesse's a handful. I saw them this morning, and they seemed pretty happy."
"Well, at least Todd..." "It's all done with," Joan said. "Being scared, being worried, being lonely. A lot of things changed in the past couple of weeks." She looked up at him.
"You're brooding."
"Sorry." Davenport had called the morning after the shooting, and the first thing he'd asked was, "How are you?"
"He never touched me," Virgil said. "That's not what I meant," Davenport said. "I meant, how's your head?"
"Don't know."
"Keep me up on it," Davenport said. "You've always been the sensitive type. It worries me."
"Okay." Davenport pushed. "Virgil, the guy was like a drunk driver, and you were the wall. It's not the wall's fault when the drunk gets killed."
"Okay.
When are you coming back?"
"No rush. You're on leave until we have the board."
"I'll be back. Couple of things to pick up here," Virgil said.
"Take it easy. If it really gets on top of you, there are pills," Davenport said.
"Believe me, they can help, I know."
"Thanks, man. Talk to you."
So Virgil and Joan looked at the clouds and picked out an elephant and a burning bush and a fat man's ass, complete with a tiny blue anus with a streak of sunshine showing through it. And Joan asked, "How'd you get so focused on Todd?"
"The revelation," Virgil said. "The book of Revelation at the Gleasons. It was planted. It was not in the crime scene photos. There are at least a couple of hundred photographs inside the Gleason place, and there was no revelation. The house was sealed up tight. Not even family was allowed inside. So it had to be a cop, or somebody with a cop. When Big Curly confessed that he'd taken Williamson through, that did it. Although, I still considered the possibility that it was one of the Curlys, or another cop." After a minute, he added, "Oh, man." Joan said, "I know you're upset, but I say thank God it's over."
"Yeah."
"Well, look, the alternative would have been a heck of a lot worse if it had been you who got shot."
"On the other hand, Margot Carr did get shot," Virgil said. "She's going to have 6 different surgeries before she's back. Hospital for a month, physical therapy. Going to have to take some skin off her thigh to make her neck right. Never going to be right." She looked him over carefully.
"You really froze him up, Virgil.
The guy was crazy."
Virgil, lying on his back, his head cupped in the palms of his hands, said, "I had a chance to talk with him before he died. Isn't that just like a cop, interrogating a dying man?"
"You didn't know he was dying," she said.
"I knew I'd shot him with a .30-06,
which wouldn't do him a hell of a lot of good.
Well, they picked out a watermelon, which was just an oval cloud, and a three-legged dog, or maybe a three-legged chicken, after the wind blew a beak on it, and Joan asked, "What'd you ask him?" Virgil wiggled his butt around on the blanket and said, "I asked him about the woman who called and told him that he was Bill Judd's son. As to whether it was an old woman or a young woman." Long silence. Then, "Oh, shit. Yeah. He said young." They sat in another cloud of silence until finally she said, "Who was the other candidate?" "Your mom?" Amy Sweet said she mentioned her at Bridge Club 3-4 years back, that Judd was getting into the ethanol business. I asked her who the members of the club were. Your mom was one of them. So how did that... A whole list of things. I couldn't figure out how Williamson knew he was Judd's son. I talked to Maggie Lane's mother, and she didn't know. She said Maggie might not have known for sure, though I suspect she did. That might have been what she and Judd were arguing about the night of the Man on the Moon party. The pregnancy. Virgil yanked a long grass stem out of its envelope, nibbled on the sweet end. Anyway, if nobody in the cities knew, then it had to come from here. And who would put Todd Williamson in with the Judds? Had to be somebody with a hard grudge against Judd. Who was that? The Strikers. It seemed too subtle to be Jim, and then you told me directly that you'd been too young to be much affected by your father's death. But your mother told me the exact opposite a couple of times. Said your father's death really tore you up. And you've been all those years out here on the farm, trying to pick up the pieces. And you got close to me the very first day I was in town, and suggested Williamson as a target. Then I got that note out of nowhere. That got me looking for a typewriter, and I never found one, but then you had those federal farm crop insurance papers, in several copies, and they were filled out with a typewriter.
Shit. Shit, shit.
More silence. When Williamson showed up and shot the dummy in your car, did you expect it to be Williamson? Or Big Curly? Or me or Jim? He shook his head. Didn't think it was you. We had the evidence of Roman Schmidt's dick to say so. He had to explain that. How'd you track him down? Virgil asked finally. How'd you find out he was crazy?
I didn't know he was crazy.
She sat up and pulled her legs against her chest, wrapped her arms around them. I knew Junior was in financial trouble, and that Senior had bad health problems. When I heard about the ethanol thing from my mother, well, we both thought it was another scam. The whole Jerusalem artichoke deal all over again, with a bunch of farmers getting screwed. I didn't know what to do about it, she said. Then I was thinking, there'd always been rumors about Lane, that the baby was Judd's, that Judd had killed her. So I wondered, what if another heir showed up? What if the whole Judd fortune had to be taken to court? If the details of the ethanol plant came out? What if somebody sued Senior for wrongful death? All kinds of things could have happened. Maybe we'd even find out where the money went from the Jerusalem artichoke business. That's what I thought. About that time, the internet was really getting going, and they had all these groups that were set up to help adopted kids track their natural parents. I got hooked up, found out how it was done. Ended up with Todd Williamson. Gave him a call, told him he was heir to a fortune. And then? Nothing. For quite a while. Then he just showed up. Never made any claims, just showed up as the editor of the Record. She frowned, tossed her hair. I don't know how he did that, but it freaked me out. And nothing happened. I knew he knew, but I couldn't say anything. I figured he was waiting for the old man to die. Or maybe he'd already talked to the old man and had made a deal. You waited. 3 years. When the Gleasons got killed, it never crossed my mind that it was Todd. Honest to God. Then old man Judd was murdered. And Jim thought, and you thought, that the two things went together. That worried me. You should have said something. I should have. I sort of did, to you, but I felt like people would blame me, she said, and I wasn't sure that it was related.
I just wasn't sure. So you sent me a note. Because nobody was doing anything about the Judds. And it seemed to me that the Judds were right at the center of all this. If they were running another scam, then wouldn't that say something about the murders? When you and Jim checked it out, you found Fur. I didn't know he was in the ethanol plant. I just knew that Judd was. And then Jim was sure that the murders were Fur, or Fur's people. So I kept letting it go, the thing about Todd. You found out pretty quick anyway. But you sort of killed the Schmitz, Joni. Oh, horse shit, she said. I thought about that. I really did, and the Gleasons. But you know what? The Gleasons killed the Gleasons. And the Schmitz killed the Schmitz. And the Johnstones would have killed the Johnstones if they'd been killed. They'd all covered up that awful murder. And what they got back was Todd Williamson. That was the return on the investment. Jesus. He would probably disapprove. After a while, Joan asked, "So what are you going to do about it?" "Nothing," Virgil said. "Go home." "That's it?" She seemed a little surprised. "I think you fucked up, Joni, but I'm not sure you've committed a crime," Virgil said. "If you have, I sure couldn't prove it." She sighed and lay back on the blanket. "Oh, gosh, Virgil." "Yeah." They picked out more clouds. An atomic bomb explosion, a semi-erect and uncircumcised penis, and the hat of the Quaker guy on the Quaker Oats label. Eventually, Joan sat up and stretched and said, "Listen, if you ever come by this way again..." Virgil pulled out another blade of grass, chewed for a second, getting the sweet out, then said, "Bite me." This is Eric Conger. We hope that you've enjoyed this production of Dark of the Moon. This program was executive produced by Patty Peruse and produced and directed by John McElroy. Dark of the Moon is a production of Penguin Audio, a member of Penguin Group USA, Inc., copyright 2007. All rights reserved.
Audible hopes you have enjoyed this program.